Hello, and welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, Brian Lynn reports on deadly automobile attacks in Spain. Later, Dan Friedel brings us what's trending today. And as always, we close the show with an American story. This week, we hear the O. Henry story from the cabbie's seat. But first, General Robert E. Lee, who led the Confederate Army during the United States Civil War, died in 1870. But in some ways, he lives today. Americans are having a heated debate about whether to remove statues of Lee and other Confederate heroes from public places. In comments to the press on Tuesday, President Donald Trump said that by removing them, you're changing history, you're changing culture. Trump did not explain what he meant by culture, but a recent poll of Americans found that 54% of Americans overall see Confederate statues as symbols of Southern pride. The polls also found that about a quarter of Americans see the statues as a symbol of something else, racism. The U.S. has at least 700 statues honoring the Confederacy across the country. They recall the U.S. Civil War of the 1860s. In that conflict, 11 Southern slaveholding states withdrew from the Union. They formed their own government, called the Confederacy. The Confederacy protected the rights of states to make their own laws, including those permitting slavery. At the time, 90% of black people in the U.S. were enslaved. After 4 years of bitter fighting, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered and effectively ended the Civil War. The Confederate states rejoined the Union. And about 3 years later, the country approved an amendment to the Constitution that legally ended slavery across the country. Manisha Sinha is a historian at the University of Connecticut. She says Americans' monuments to the Confederacy are unusual for several reasons. First, Sinha says, unlike any other country in the world, the U.S. actually has statues commemorating people from the South who committed treason against the U.S. government. Second, she says, the Confederacy was based on the belief of white people's superiority over black people. For example, the Vice President of the Confederacy, Andrew Stevens, wrote, "Our new government is founded upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition." As a result, says Sinha, Confederate heroes are not innocuous markers of American history.
In fact, these figures represent a short-lived nation that was in rebellion against the United States, and that really stood for slavery and white supremacy.
But in the decades following the Civil War, some Americans' perceptions of the Confederacy changed. In 1915, a woman writes why she has joined an organization called the Daughters of the Confederacy. The writer describes a Southern culture, or way of life, characterized by bravery, honor, glory, and ladylike behavior. She says she is honoring her ancestors' struggle in the Civil War. She writes, "I do not consider the cause which he held so dear to be lost or forgotten. Rather, I am extremely proud of the fact that he was a part of it and was numbered among some of the greatest and bravest men which any such cause ever produced." Historian James Oliver Horton was a professor at George Washington University. He says historians in the later 20th century find overwhelming evidence that slavery really was a central cause of the Civil War. In his essay, "The Civil War Remembered," Horton writes, "When Southern whites in the 19th century spoke of the Southern way of life, they referred to a way of life founded on white supremacy and supported by the institution of slavery." Modern historians find additional evidence that public statues of Confederate forces are more complicated than they might appear. Notably, most Confederate monuments were not built immediately after the Civil War. The majority were built at the turn of the 20th century and in the 1950s, when some white Americans were protesting strongly against increasing the civil rights of Black Americans. Historian April Holm at the University of Mississippi writes, "Most are not Confederate-era monuments, as I have seen them called. These are primarily Jim Crow-era monuments." Jim Crow refers to laws and sanctions aimed at ethnic discrimination, especially against African Americans. As an era, it lasted from the late 1800s to the mid-1950s. The dispute over whether to remove Confederate monuments from public places has flared up many times in Americans' public conversation. In 2015, lawmakers in South Carolina, which had been the first state to withdraw from the Union in 1860, voted to remove the Confederate battle flag from its Capitol grounds. The decision followed the shooting of 9 African American people in a South Carolina church by a young white man. The shooter said he was motivated by his anger at African Americans. Polls this week suggest very few Americans who want to preserve Confederate memorials support extreme racist views. One woman who rallied last weekend to keep the statue of Robert E. Lee in a public park told the New York Times that she and her friends were simply gun-loving defenders of free speech who had no interest in standing with Nazis or white supremacists. What might be more important in America's different perceptions of the Confederate monuments is political affiliation. Democrats are about evenly divided on keeping or removing the statues. But a majority of Republicans, the party to which President Donald Trump belongs, strongly favor keeping the statues in place. Interestingly, one opponent of memorials to the Confederacy is Robert E. Lee himself. Several years after the Civil War, he warned against raising monuments to the Confederacy. He wrote, "I think it wiser not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife."
Once again, terrorists have used vehicles to carry out deadly attacks, this time in Spain. At least 14 people were killed in two attacks in different areas. More than 100 others were injured. On Thursday, a van struck a crowd on a busy street in the Spanish city of Barcelona. The attack took place on Las Ramblas, a road leading from the center of the city to the coast. The area, which has many stores and restaurants, was filled with people enjoying a summer day. Police said the driver of the vehicle fled on foot. The second attack happened early Friday, about 130 kilometers south of Barcelona, in the seaside town of Cambrils. Attackers drove a passenger car into a crowd, killing one person and injuring at least five others. Police said they killed five attackers after the incident in Cambrils. Spanish officials said it appeared the attackers had explosives tied to their bodies, but the bombs turned out to be fake. Officials said at least four suspects, three Moroccans and a Spaniard, were arrested. I'm Brian Lynn.
Bonnie Tyler had a hit song in 1983. It is called "Total Eclipse of the Heart." Thirty-four years ago, the song reached the number one position on popular music charts in both the United States and her native Britain. Bonnie Tyler made a number of records in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It was perhaps the most successful period in her recording career. Tyler is now 66 years old. She is still performing, mostly in Europe. A lot of people have been thinking about Tyler lately. That is because of her song, "Total Eclipse of the Heart," and the total solar eclipse on Monday, August 21st. A solar eclipse takes place when the moon passes in front of the sun, blocking the sunlight during the day. Royal Caribbean International has announced that Bonnie Tyler will perform her song aboard one of its cruise ships on Monday. The ship leaves from Miami, Florida, for a 7-day trip on Sunday, August 20th. It will sail to an area of the Atlantic Ocean where passengers will have a chance to experience the period when the moon passes directly in front of the sun. There is a narrow path where people will be able to experience what is known as totality. That is when the moon is perfectly framed by the sun. On August 21st, the United States will be the best place on Earth to experience the total eclipse. The U.S. Space Agency, NASA, is predicting that totality will occur in a number of states, including Oregon, Nebraska, Illinois, Kentucky, and South Carolina. Another good place to be is in the Atlantic Ocean, to the east of Miami. That is where the passenger ship plans to be. In June, Royal Caribbean announced the trip, noting a major headliner. And that person turned out to be Bonnie Tyler. She will be joined by Joe Jonas's band, DNCE. Jonas was formerly part of the group known as the Jonas Brothers. DNCE's most famous song came out in 2015. It is called Cake by the Ocean. I'm Dan Friedel.
Learning English is bringing you a new weekly show. What It Takes is a podcast of conversations with well-known people in almost every field. The interviews have been recorded over the past 25 years by the American Academy of Achievement. They offer the life stories of people who have had a huge impact on the world. Here's a little taste of What It Takes.
And why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down.
Hardscrabble farmers, homeless drifters, and men behind bars. These are the people Johnny Cash wrote and sang about for 40-plus years. He lent his entirely original canyon of a voice to the lonesome and the lost, the dispossessed and the disillusioned. In 1993, Gail Eichenthal sat down to talk with Johnny Cash. It was 10 years before his death.
The first time I knew what I wanted to do with my life was when I was about 4 years old. I was listening to an old Vic Trola playing a railroad song. The song was called Hobo Bill's Last Ride.
Hobo Bill, a railroad bum, was fighting for his life.
And I thought that was the most wonderful, amazing thing that I'd ever seen, that you could take this piece of wax and music would come out of that box. From that day on, I wanted to sing on the radio.
You can find What It Takes on the Learning English website starting August 19th.
From the cabbie's seat. The cabbie has his own special place from which he looks at life. His view of people is simpler, perhaps, than the view of a man who does any other kind of work. From the high seat of his cab, he looks down upon everybody. People are not important to him unless they wish to go somewhere. Then, they're only something to be carried from one place to another. You may be the president or you may be no one, but to a cabbie, you are only a fare, only someone who rides in his cab for a price. You get into his cab, he shakes you a while, and he puts you down. Then the time for payment has arrived. If you pay him the lawful amount and no more, you can easily see what he thinks of you. He thinks you're less than nothing. If you discover suddenly that you have no money with you, you'll wish you were dead. It is probably true that the cabbie's view of life is formed by the shape of his cab. He sits up there on his seat high as a god. The seat is small. No one shares it with him. While you are in his cab, your future is in his hands. You are helpless. The cab shakes you. You can't get out until he stops his horse. If you want to speak to him, you must talk through a little hole in the back of the cab. In a cab, you no longer feel like a person. You may be someone very important, but in a cab, you're no more than something in a box being carried from one place to another. One night, there were sounds of pleasure and joy in the big house beside McGarry's family restaurant. The sounds seemed to come from the rooms of the Walsh family. A crowd of interested neighbors stood outside the door. Again and again, a waiter came bringing food or drink from the restaurant. The neighbors stood aside every time to let him pass. Then they would move near the door again. And all the time they were talking about what was happening inside. Anyone who listened would have learned quickly and easily that Nora Walsh was being married. After some time had gone by, the happy people started coming out the door. They mixed at once with the neighbors who were standing there. Joyful cries and laughing voices rose in the night air. All this noise was born of the drinks from McGarry's restaurant. At the edge of the street stood Jerry O'Donovan's cab. No cleaner or more shining cab could be found. And Jerry's horse! I tell you, he was fat with good food. Among the moving crowd, Jerry's high hat could now and then be seen. His nose, too, could be seen. It was thick and red, for it had been beaten by fares who wanted to fight. And also now and then, his fine green coat appeared. It was easy to see that Jerry had had more than enough to drink. Everyone had noticed it. Out of the crowd in the street, or perhaps from among the people walking past the house, came a young woman. She stopped beside the cab. Jerry saw her there. A fare! He made a sudden move and three or four people near him fell down. He himself? No. He caught himself in time and did not fall. Quickly, he went up to his seat. When he was there, he was safe. All of McGarry's drink could not throw him down from there. "Step in, lady," said Jerry. The young woman stepped into the cab. The door closed. The crowd on the street jumped away. The horse started and the fine cab rolled down the street. The horse went fast at first, but after a little time he went more slowly. Then Jerry called down through the hole in the back of the cab. He tried to make his voice soft. He wished to please. "Where will you be going to?"
"Any place you wish,"
was the answer. The voice was happy. It sounded like music. "Ah, she's riding for pleasure," thought Jerry. Then he said, "Take a trip in the park, lady. It will be cool and fine."
"Just as you wish,"
answered the fare pleasantly. The cab turned towards Fifth Avenue, then went north on that perfect street. Jerry was moved up and down in his seat and from one side to the other. McGarry's drinks moved at the same time and seemed to rise inside his head. He began to sing. Inside the cab, the fare sat up straight on the seat. She looked to the right and to the left at the lights in the houses. It was dark inside the cab, and her eyes were shining like stars. When they came to 59th Street, Jerry was half asleep, but his horse went through the park gate. The horse knew where they were. The horse pulled the cab into the park every night. And the fare sat there as if in a happy dream. She could smell the clean, fresh smell of green leaves and flowers. And the wise animal pulling the cab moved as usual. He was at home here. Jerry, too, tried to do as he did every night. His voice was thick, but he asked the questions that cabbies always ask in the park. "You want to stop at the casino restaurant, lady? I had something to eat. Listen to the music.
Everyone stops.
I think that would be nice, said the fare.
They made a sudden stop at the door of the restaurant. The cab door opened, the fare stepped out. At once she seemed caught by the wonderful music. The lights and the colors were bright, almost blinding. Someone put a piece of paper into her hand. On it was a number, 34. She looked around and saw her cab. It was 20 yards away, taking its place in a line with other waiting cabs. She was led inside and soon was seated at a table. She realized that she was expected to buy something. She had a little money. She counted it and found enough to buy something cold and fresh to drink. There she sat, drinking slowly and looking at everything around her. Life here had new color, a new shape. It did not seem real. It was like a beautiful dream. At 50 tables sat people who looked to her like kings and queens. She thought their clothes and jewels were wonderfully rich. And now and then, one of these people would look at her. They saw a small woman in a simple dress. They saw a plain face. But on that face, they saw an expression of love of life. And the queens wished that they could look the same. While she sat there, 2 hours passed. The kings and queens began to leave. Their cabs rolled away. The music ended. The waiters took everything off the tables near hers. She was sitting there almost alone. Jerry's fare stood up and held out the numbered piece of paper.
"Is someone going to give me something for this?"
she asked. A waiter told her that it was for her cab. He said that she should go to the door and give it to the man there. This man took it and called the number. Only 3 cabs stood in line now. The driver of one of them went and found Jerry asleep inside his cab. Jerry spoke a few words in anger and then went up to his seat. He turned the horse and the cab rolled to the door and stopped. His fare entered. The cab turned again and went through the cool darkness of the park, following the street that would lead most quickly to the gate. At the gate, Jerry began suddenly to think. He was still half asleep, but there was a doubt in his mind. There were 1 or 2 things he had to ask about. He stopped his horse, and his voice came down through the hole in the back of the cab.
"I want to see $4 before we go any further. Have you got any money?"
$4? Laughed the fare softly. "No, I've only got a few cents with me."
Jerry made the horse run. The animal's feet were very loud on the street, but above the noise of the horse's feet, Jerry's voice could be heard. He was full of anger. He shouted at the stars in the sky. He shouted at other cabs as they passed. His words were so bad that another driver hearing them could not believe his ears. But Jerry knew what he was going to do about this fare without money. He knew where he was going. At the building with the green lights beside the door, he pulled his horse to a stop. He opened the cab door and jumped to the ground. "Come on, you," he said, and his voice was hard. His fare came out with the dreaming smile still on her plain face. Jerry took her by the arm and led her inside. He was going to tell the cops what had happened. They would do something about it. A gray-haired cop looked across the table. He and the cabbie were no strangers. Jerry began in his loud, hard voice, "I've got a fare here that..." Jerry stopped. He put his hand, reddened by the weather, to his face. The drink from McGarry's restaurant no longer clouded his mind so darkly. "A fare, sir," he continued with a wide smile, "that I want you to meet. It's my wife that I married at Old Man Walsh's this evening. And a wild time we had, it's true. Shake hands with him, Nora, and we'll go home." Before stepping into the cab again, Nora took a long, deep breath.
"I've had a very nice time, Jerry," said she.
That's all the time we have for today's show. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us.